Rings, Swords, and Monsters, Lecture 8. Tolkien, The Silmarillion, and Later Works.
Back in 1937, The Hobbit had been so successful that Tolkien's publishers had clamored for a sequel, as had many, many fans. 17 years later, Tolkien gave them The Lord of the Rings. When The Lord of the Rings was published in 1954, people immediately began clamoring for a sequel for that, and Tolkien thought this was his chance to finally publish his material for The Silmarillion. Unfortunately, that material was in such a complex and disorganized state that it didn't lend itself well to being published in one volume. Tolkien did spend the next 18 or 19 years trying to work on it as people became more and more excited about A Silmarillion. He had people come over from America to try to help him with it. He worked with his son, but he could never give it a complete shape. And when he died in 1973, The Silmarillion was still unpublished. Some critics have said things should have remained that way, which is a bit harsh. But finally, in 1977, 4 years after Tolkien's death, his son Christopher put together at least a small compendium of the legends and material of the first age of Middle-earth, and this became The Silmarillion. When it came out and people flocked to the stores to buy it, they were in for a major shock, because The Silmarillion is nothing like The Lord of the Rings. It begins with a creation story. It has very few speaking characters, or at least dialogue. Characters do speak, but they don't really speak much to each other. They sort of declaim long and impassioned speeches. It has no hobbits at all, and therefore there's no mediation between the ancient world and the imaginary world of Tolkien and the reader. What that meant was that The Silmarillion came across, as someone said, it's the Elvish Bible, and in fact it reads very similarly to the King James Bible. So this may seem like a very strange topic for this next lecture in the course. After all, The Silmarillion is notoriously difficult to read. It's not clear how many people actually do read The Silmarillion as opposed to how many millions of them have bought it, and it's hard to understand. But I want to make the argument that if you understand what's going on in The Silmarillion, and I don't mean by any means to try to summarize the plot of this gigantic book, but if you understand what Tolkien is trying to accomplish and what he's trying to create, the first thing is the success of The Lord of the Rings makes a lot more sense. The aesthetic success of The Lord of the Rings, the sense that there are vast backdrops and ancient histories beyond The Lord of the Rings, they give that narrative so much depth that people feel as if they've really experienced it. Well, that depth is created not just by little gimmicks and tricks, but by the fact that Tolkien wrote up several thousand years of history, sometimes close to year by year, that he built into The Silmarillion, and that was all behind The Lord of the Rings when he was writing it. But I first want to acknowledge some of the problems, and these are literary historical problems and literary theoretical problems that are associated with The Silmarillion. The first question is, what order should you read the books? Now, I've presented in what could be called the traditional order, The Hobbit, because that was published first, and then The Lord of the Rings, and then The Silmarillion. Tolkien's son Christopher, who edited all the material, believes that you should start with The Silmarillion, then read The Hobbit, and then The Lord of the Rings. Now, obviously, he doesn't think this is particularly practical advice, because the kind of person who'd pick up The Hobbit and just enjoy it as a good story, particularly children who would read The Hobbit that way, would not be able to get through The Silmarillion. I myself read The Silmarillion when I was 9 years old, but I'm very unusual in that sense. Most of the young readers who pick up The Silmarillion don't get past the first few pages.